in Houston. RSVP at HoustonWomen'sMarch.org. KPFT Houston.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. And since this is the first program of the new year, I thought we'd try something new. I thought we'd explore how stories are incorporated in other forms of art. I was discussing this with Hank, and it struck us that stories are seeds for all types of artistic expression. Consider the visual arts, for example. If you go to an art museum, you'll see these visual masterpieces. But the inspiration for them is often a story. I think, for example, of the works of Michelangelo. I see the sculpture of David. It's magnificent. It's amazing from a technical standpoint. But I think what also makes it so amazing to me is that I'm thinking about a story behind that. I'm thinking about a boy who fought a giant. I'm thinking about that boy who then grew up into a man and had some other stories about some more internal struggles with classic temptations like sex and power, between his personal conscience and interpersonal conflict. And so the story, I think, informed the artist, and the artist was somehow able to express all the conflict and passion and pathos of those stories. If you think about the Pietà, it's an amazing sculpture, but again, what I think inspired that sculpture was an amazing story. A mother, her son, the son dies prematurely, and in a tragic and yet somehow a redemptive way. And somehow Michelangelo is able to not only be inspired by that story, but able to portray it all in one piece of sculpture. And then there's one other piece of art. I just can't help but mention one of the great paintings, Mona Lisa. What is it she's smiling about? She's not saying. Leonardo da Vinci is not saying. For centuries, we've tried to decode that story, no pun intended, Da Vinci, decode the story behind that smile. And so there is art that at least appears to be inspired by stories we don't even know. And it raises questions in our mind, what is the story? So if we turn to music, which is our medium we'll be dealing with tonight, our listeners at KPFT, I think, are very much in tune, for example, with folk music. And we know that all the great folk songs are inspired by stories. Woody Guthrie was inspired by his experiences during the Dust Bowl and the Depression. More recently, Peter, Paul, and Mary, by the Vietnam War, by the Civil Rights Movement. And then more personally, I guess, all the trials and tribulations that we go through as we transition from youth to adulthood, as we grow up and leave home and find love and meaning in our lives. Those stories informed their amazing folk songs. Well, so I think we'll all agree that folk music has been inspired for decades by stories. Stories have been the seeds of that music. But in fairness, I think we'd have to say opera has been inspired by stories for centuries. And since we're so fortunate to live in Houston, where we have one of the nation's finest operas, it only makes sense that we take some time on this show to discover the inextricable connection between story and the opera that it supports. And no one anywhere has done a better job over the years of telling and interpreting opera stories than tonight's guest, Eric Skelly and St. John Flynn. Eric has been writing about opera for 30 years. His work has appeared in the Houston Chronicle, Time Out New York, Houston Grand Opera Cues, and Playbill. St. John was born and raised in Britain. He lived and worked in France for 2 years before coming to the U.S. for graduate school in French literature. He worked as a host and producer for public radio and television for more than 20 years, most recently as arts and culture director for Houston Public Media, where, among other things, he produced what I would say is the incredibly informative, interesting, and often downright hilarious podcast called The Opera Cheat Sheet. So with that introduction, Eric and St. John, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you very much for having
Thank
us.
Thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're just delighted. I'm honored. I'm a little bit intimidated. I've listened to you guys on the radio over the years, and you guys are really good.
Thanks so much.
Well, we have a long history together, so...
We do.
We know each other's foibles.
And I'm going to say you have a unique style of storytelling. You tell stories as a pair. It reminds me of, say, my brother and I, you know, if we're asked to tell about something and I start the story and then he jumps in and say, no, but what about this? And then I say, but how about that? And the way you tell together, as our audience is about to experience, is just amazing. I guess what I'd like to start out with is asking you two or three questions, and then we're going to just jump right into the a sampler from the Opera Cheat Sheet.
Sounds great.
At KPFT, as I said earlier, we're primarily known for other types of music, folk music, blues, Texas singer-songwriters, country. And so it strikes me that we may have one or two listeners out there who are not so familiar with the music of opera. What would you like to say to them right now, other than shame on you?
No shaming. It's popular entertainment. Opera at its core, that's what it began as. Uh-huh. In the 20th century, I think it gained a little bit of notoriety as, you know, sort of highfalutin and highbrow, and that I think has sort of, we've left that behind as well. And it's mm-hmm. going back to what it originally was. It was popular entertainment.
It was the musical theater of its day.
Yeah.
You know, you think of anybody that's seen the movie Amadeus. Uh-huh. You have Mozart coming to the court of the emperor and talking. They're talking about opera in Italian,
yeah.
which was, if you like, the sort of the highfalutin stuff of the day. But he had this desire to write opera in German.
Yes.
But that was considered sort of more popular.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've had the same divisions and the same attitudes from opera right from the, you know, from its earliest days. But it still is today, it's mm-hmm. music theater. But, you know, back in Mozart's time, it was popular music.
Well, yeah. Verdi was, and he was the rock star of his day. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Giuseppe Verdi, the great composer Verdi, composed Aida, Rigoletto, Trovatore, Traviata. He was the rock star of his time.
Yeah.
I mean, no exaggeration.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, these were the days before television and radio, and
right.
you know, people entertained themselves differently. And so, you know, to go to the opera or to go to the theater was not as strange as it might be for people today.
So is Leonard Bernstein's
West Side Story,
is that opera?
Absolutely.
Arguably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I think. Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those musical theater pieces that greatly benefits from having the resources of an opera company to produce it,
yeah.
because the lead roles in that really require, you can do it with sort of Broadway belt voices, but they're better served if you have somebody who has a classical background and can really do that music justice.
Another example, of course, is Stephen Sondheim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are many of his pieces, or I shouldn't say many, there are several of his pieces that are regularly performed by major opera companies, you know, A Little Night Music and
Sweeney Todd,
mm-hmm. Because, you know, these have operatic qualities.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you think back to the early days of the 20th century with the operas like Showboat and that were coming out of popular literature, but they were also coming out of the operatic tradition and sort of heralding in musical theatre as we know it today.
Yeah. Right.
How did the two of you come up with the idea of creating this podcast?
St. John gets the credit for that.
Well, when I was working for KUHF and its sister station, Classical 91.7, I was the program director, and I was looking for a way to enhance our musical offerings, if you like. And you know, we always used to carry the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts on a Saturday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of opera. I love it. And I wanted to be able to do more, to create more around that operatic programming. And so I knew that we had an expert on staff at the station. And so I thought, you know, we have Eric, who is the expert, and it would be wonderful to be able to exploit his knowledge. And also, I mean, he's got a great radio voice. He's got the knowledge.
Yeah.
And we have a very good connection humoristically.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that was in place from the get-go. It really was. It grew as we went along, but right from the very start, it was just fun.
And that's what comes
we're very irreverent.
Yes.
I mean, it's which is part of that idea of not holding opera up as something sacred and you know, only for the elite. I mean, we laugh a lot because there is a lot to laugh about in opera.
Some of the, you know, the plots are just completely absurd, and we will, you know, not shrink from saying so. You know, but the music always transcends that, and that's what you're left with at the end of the podcast at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Well, as a listener, my strongest memory is that you guys seem to be having too much fun, and the second one is that you have maybe not reverence for opera, but deep. Because you are irreverent in a way, you're willing to critique it, but you have
but
just
deeply
a deep love of opera.
We deeply love it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're not too late. We're just getting started. You're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online, of course, at www.kpft.org. My guests tonight are St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly from the amazing podcast, The Opera Cheat Sheet. And those of you who listen regularly to our show will know that our guests typically either tell personal stories or traditional folk tales. Tonight, in honor of the new year, we're telling stories from a different genre, the world of fine arts, and specifically opera. Those who listen regularly will also know that we typically have our guests tell these short stories, and we intersperse those stories with a conversation. But again, in honor of the new year, we're going to try a different format tonight. Offenbach's Tales of Hoffman is a collection of shorter tales that together comprise, and this is the important part, together they comprise one big tale. We don't want to violate the integrity of the big tale. So for the next 30 minutes or so, I'm going to turn the show over to St. John and Eric and let them tell these shorter tales and that one big tale in their own inimitable way. Relax and enjoy what I think may be the first ever live broadcast of the Opera Cheat Sheet.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
It is indeed.
Great. We take it away, guys.
Okay.
Well, when we were trying to decide what opera should we do for this occasion, you know, we tossed around a lot of ideas, The Flying Dutchman and Don Giovanni and a lot of different ideas, but it just seemed like a no-brainer that it really should be The Tales of Hoffman by Jacques Offenbach, because it's an opera about storytelling. I mean, it has a frame story in which the title character tells the three stories of his tragic lost loves. And the title character in this opera is, of course, E.T.A. Hoffman, who was one of the great storytellers of all time. From him we get The Nutcracker, and we get Coppelia, and you know, so this just sort of lent itself to the show.
With your permission, then, Warren, we'd like to just sort of do our thing, our shtick, and and you know, you might have to jump in to stop us if we get too riotous. Are you ready, Eric?
Let's go.
Okay. Welcome to the Opera Cheat Sheet. I'm St. John Flynn.
And I'm Eric Skelly.
And this time we're talking about Jacques Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann, Les Contes d'Hoffmann, which debuted in Paris in 1881.
4 months after the composer died.
I know. And the sad thing is that he didn't even finish the opera.
No.
Most of it, but he didn't actually get to finish it. And this was, I mean, it was his swan song, but this was the first serious, quote-unquote, serious opera that he wrote. He'd been known for a whole string of very successful operettas.
Light operas, exactly. But this was supposed to be the one that immortalized him. This was his magnum opus. And he didn't even, and he just wanted to see the first performance, and he didn't make it, sadly.
It was completed by a guy called Ernest Girard, who had also done some other completion work. I think he did some of the completion work on Carmen.
Uh-huh.
And
he was famous for basically, for this and for Carmen and for others, for completing the recitative. Recitative is a fancy-sounding word in opera. It's the connecting music that connects the arias and the duets and the ensembles. You know, so instead of spoken dialogue, Giraud composed these recitatives, and that's how people heard The Tales of Hoffmann for many, many years, until we started going back to a more authentic performing version where we restored the dialogue, and that's where we are today.
Because there were operas, Eric, that some of Mozart's, for example, what were called Singspiels,
mm-hmm.
which didn't have recitatives as we know them today, but they had spoken dialogue.
Right.
And so it was spoken dialogue, and then aria, and spoken dialogue, and duet, etc. But here we have these recitatives completed by Girard.
So we had lots of different versions of The Tales of Hoffmann over the years because it premiered so long after the composer's death. We had the Chudin's version for years and years and years with the Giraud recitatives, and then that gave way to an Oeze version, and that gave way to a K version, and now we've got all these sort of hybrid versions, everyone trying to get closer and closer to an authentic performance of The Tales of Hoffmann, exactly as Offenbach wanted it.
And of course, you know, there are adherents to all the different forms of the opera, and sometimes they don't see eye to eye. It can get quite ugly.
Can. It can.
We're going to talk about the opera in terms of what people generally today consider to be the order that Offenbach himself wanted them.
The way he wanted it, yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that's prologue, three acts, which are three different stories, and then an epilogue.
Right. So, shall we dive into the prologue?
Go on.
Let's do it.
Go on.
So the prologue is where is the storytelling part of this. It establishes the fact that we're listening to Hoffmann telling a story, and it opens in Nuremberg in a tavern, and all these students are all gathering there because there's a next door at the opera house there's a performance of Don Giovanni in progress. Perhaps significant because we have Don Giovanni and we have The Tales of Hoffmann, both operas with protagonists who strike out with three different women. In the course of the opera. Just saying.
And there's actually a sort of a weird connection between Don Giovanni Mozart and E.T.A. Hoffmann. E.T.A. Hoffmann was, his name, when he was born, was Ernst Theodor Wilhelm Hoffmann. It was E.T.W. Hoffmann. But he actually changed his name to E.T.A. Hoffmann, and the A was Amadeus.
Oh.
Because he was such a fan of Mozart's.
Right.
And so here we have Don Giovanni playing in the opera house next door, and Hoffmann comes into the tavern, and he's not happy.
No, he's quite drunk.
And he's going to get drunker.
He's going to get a lot drunker as the evening wears on. He has a bit of an alcohol problem, I think we can safely say.
Yeah, and he is a poet.
Right.
He is an artist, a creator, and that's something that plays into the whole of this opera. He's not happy. He comes into the tavern.
Right.
And in the tavern of the students, but there's also Lindorf, Counselor Lindorf.
And this guy's going to be significant because there are going to be characters that reoccur across all the tales. There's an evil genius in every tale. And this thwarting Hoffman and Counselor Lindorf in the epilogue and the prologue is that evil genius. He's there to thwart Hoffman.
He's the nemesis of Hoffman.
Exactly.
And Hoffman's not happy. He comes into the bar, gets a couple of beers in him, and the students all ask him, because they know what his job is, you know what he does, they all ask him to tell them a story.
Right. So he does.
Yeah.
He tells the Ballad of Kleinzach, who is this funny-looking little dwarf whose knees click-clack together, and he describes how oddly shapen the dwarf is, and he starts to talk about the dwarf's face, and then he sort of goes off into this reverie, and he starts thinking about the face of the woman he loves, and the music changes very dramatically at this point, and he just goes off on this tangent, and then snaps back and finishes the Ballad of Kleinzach.
And the woman that he's thinking of is Stella.
The diva.
The diva, because she's next door in the opera house singing one of the roles in Don Giovanni.
Yes.
And we're actually between acts, which is why the students have come into the tavern.
Right.
To, you know, intermission drink.
Yeah.
And Hoffman has come in from the opera house and obviously has Stella and he has love on the brain.
And he's thinking about his past loves. And the students all say, well, tell us about them. And he says, yeah, you want me to? And they all say, yeah, we screw the opera.
Screw the opera.
Let's just stay here and listen to Hoffman. Yeah, so they do. They all settle in. And he says, the name of the first of the great loves of my life is Olympia.
Now, this act, the Olympia act, is actually based on a story by E.T.A. Hoffman called The Sandman.
Der Sandman.
And it's set in Paris. And Hoffman is, within the context of this story, we don't know when it is in his life. We assume, obviously, it's earlier in his life. But he has renounced poetry. And he has decided he wants to devote himself to science. And he has got to know this scientist, a professor of physics called Spallanzani. And Spallanzani has a distinctive daughter.
A renowned daughter, as it were. Her name is Olympia.
Olympia. And what is special about Olympia is she's not really a good daughter because she's
not real.
She's not real. She's a robot. She's an automaton.
Yeah.
And Spallanzani has worked with this strange figure, Coppelius.
Right.
To develop this automaton.
And he's trying to... Well, the contribution that Coppelius has made to Olympia is her eyes.
Right.
And he hasn't been paid yet. And he's coming around to Spallanzani to try to, you know, pay up. And it turns out that Spallanzani has fallen on hard times because he had some investments with a banker named Elias. And Elias has gone bankrupt. And he's hoping to use Olympia to, you know,
replenish the coffers.
Replenish the coffers. Thank you. That's the perfect phrase for that.
And Coppelius is concerned that Spallanzani is going to get all this money and is not going to give him what he believes is his due.
Right.
So he shows up at the house And
Coppelius writes him a check.
No, Spallanzani writes Coppelius a check.
I'm sorry, Spallanzani, thank you.
Knowing, and he writes it on the
bank
account
of
Elias.
Mm-hmm. And he knowing knows that it's going to bounce.
It's going to bounce, big time.
So off goes Coppelius to cash the check. And meanwhile, guests begin to arrive for this party in which Spallanzani is going to debut his magnificent daughter, Olympia.
And Hoffman is there, and he's seen the daughter, and he's fallen in love with her. I mean, she's actually asleep, isn't she, when he first sees her? So he doesn't get to see that she's perhaps not quite real.
But there's a little hinkiness involved in that too, because before Coppelius left, he sells Hoffman a pair of glasses, and they're literally, you know, many productions, they're rose tinted glasses. So when Hoffman looks at Olympia through these glasses, he sees a real girl, and he's absolutely madly in love with her, so he thinks.
Now, you know, we haven't mentioned
Niklaus,
who is Hoffman's sidekick.
His best friend.
And in the opera, mm-hmm. it's sung by a mezzo-soprano, so it's a female voice. It's what we call a pants roll.
Mm-hmm. Or a trouser roll.
A trouser roll.
Right.
Trousers in Britain, pants over here.
There you go.
And Niklaus, of course, knows, he can see quite clearly that Olympia is not real. That she's an automaton.
A mechanical doll.
But Hoffman can't see that.
At all. So all the guests arrive, and Spallanzani trots out his daughter Olympia and has her accompanied on the harp, and she sings this famous aria, Les oiseaux dans la charmille, the birds in the bower. And it's this coloratura. And when we say coloratura, we're talking about a soprano who sings very florid, fast, light, highly decorated, high music. And this is a showpiece for coloraturas, the doll's aria. And
this is her debut.
Yes.
And this is Spallanzani hoping that, of course, she's going to impress everybody.
Yeah.
And that he's going to be able to market this automaton.
Right. And the music in this is really brilliant because it's written in such a way as to demonstrate to us clearly that this is a mechanical doll. It's very, for a coloratura, it's very mechanical sounding. And it's very virtuosic. And it's very difficult.
And the great thing that Offenbach does is he makes it sound, as you say, like it's being sung by a robot in some respects. It's very clean and disjointed staccato.
And she runs out of juice a couple times in the middle of it and has to be wound back up again.
So, Coppelius arrives back
and
at the house.
He's furious.
He's very furious, isn't he?
Yeah.
And part of this, one of the weirdness of this story is that Spallanzani and Coppelius are sort of vying for fatherhood of Olympia.
Yeah.
And when Spallanzani gave Coppelius the check before he went off to the bank, he was paying him off. He was saying, okay, you've done your part, I'm paying you for it. She's mine now, I'm her daddy. And Coppelius no longer has any claim over her. But then, of course, he gets tricked by Spallanzani and he comes back for revenge.
So meanwhile, the party's going on. Olympia dances with Hoffman at one point and nearly kills him. He can't keep up with her. And finally, Spallanzani has to intervene and, you know, sends her back to her room to kind of let her cool down a little bit. And meanwhile, you hear all this crashing and banging going on, and out comes Coppelius, who's gotten his revenge. He's torn her apart.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that when she dances with Hoffman, and she gets sort of manic, and they go faster and round and round and round and faster, and Hoffman falls over, knocks himself unconscious, and he breaks the glasses that he's wearing. So when he comes around,
and Coppelius is coming out with Olympia in pieces, literally in pieces, suddenly Hoffman is horrified to realize that this young girl that he's fallen in love with was never real to begin with, and everybody in the party laughs at him and mocks the foolish young man who fell in love with the mechanical doll.
End of the act.
End of act one.
We move then straight into act two, and act two is set in Munich.
Yes, in the House of Kreisspell, and in fact that's the name of the story that this comes from, Rat Kreisspell, or Counselor Kreisspell.
Sometimes also known as the Cremona Violin,
yeah.
Story. And Kreisspell has a daughter named Antonia.
Yes.
And Antonia was dating Hoffman.
They have a past.
They do. But Kreisspell whisked her away to Munich to get her away from Hoffman. Because she has the possibility of being really close to death.
Yes, she's one of those operatic heroines. She has consumption, which is to say tuberculosis. And her mother was a singer, and so is she. Her mother died we presume, consumption as well, and her father is terrified that the same fate is going to befall his daughter, and is basically trying to seclude her, in essence, in this house in Munich, to keep her calm, to keep her from singing, keep her alive.
Because he gets her to promise that she will no longer sing. And he knows that Hoffman is a sort of an instigator, because she'll sing when she's happy.
Yeah.
But Hoffman tracks them down,
yeah,
in Munich, because he's in love with Antonia.
Yeah. And he finds his way into the house, and they have this wonderful, glorious reunion with a beautiful duet, and, you know, re-pledge their love for one another before Hoffman goes away.
Well, because one of the things, this is one of the things that really gets me about this opera, and any opera where the heroine is dying. It's like, I'm dying, I'm dying, I'm dying, but hang on, I can't die before I finish singing this aria.
I've got a cadenza to go.
And as Antonia and Hoffman reunite, she sings.
Yeah.
And she starts to get a little bit faint. And, you know, because Hoffman's worried, doesn't want her father to see him, so he goes and hides.
He pretends to go, but he actually hides to kind of see what's going on here. And so Antonio's father comes back, Kreisspell comes back, and who should show up at the door but Dr. Miracle. Now this is the next of these evil geniuses, these nemesis that are always seeking to thwart Hoffman.
Like Lindorf and Coppelius,
yeah,
as we've already seen.
This one is the scariest one of all of them, I have to say. He is seriously creepy. He comes in, and Kreisspell doesn't want him anywhere near his house, because this is the man who, quote, took care of his wife, end quote, and then she died. And he suspects that Dr. Miracle had a hand in that, so he doesn't want him anywhere near his daughter. So Dr. Miracle comes and is inquiring as to the health of Antonia. She's out of the room. She's all the way in another part of the house. But he proceeds to do an examination of Antonia in absentia. He pretends to, you know, he seems to be examining her, but she's not there. And then he asks her to sing. And then from another part of the house, you hear, you know, you hear this scale, and then she goes up to a high note and then drops back down again as if she's fainted. And it's seriously creepy. It's just really creepy.
He has this magical, fantastic quality to him, Dr. Miracle, more so than we see, I think, in any of the other nemeses.
Magical in a sort of demonic way,
yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah. So Crespel sends him out of the house again. But he gets back in. Dr. Miracle gets back in. They lock the door once they kick him out. But he gets back in because he just walks through the wall.
Yeah.
As you do.
Right. When you're a demon. So Hoffman has been watching all of this. And watching as Crespel has told his daughter, you must not sing. You'll die. If you keep singing, you will die. You know, and she's crestfallen at the thought of never being able to sing again because it means so much to her and who she is. You know, she's an artist. But she promises. And then when Crespel goes and Hoffman comes out and says to her, you know, I love you, but you can't, you have to promise me that you will never sing again. And she does. She promises him.
But.
She doesn't keep it long.
No, because Dr. Miracle intervenes again.
He comes back in after Hoffman's left.
And he does this weird thing. On the wall in the room, there is a painting of her mother.
Yes.
Antonia's mother. And she hears, from time to time, she can hear her mother's voice singing.
Yeah.
And what happens is Dr. Miracle works his magic, and the picture comes alive and starts to sing.
And urges her to sing. Urges her to sing with her. And she does. And then Dr. Miracle grabs this violin off the wall and starts to accompany them. And they have this amazing trio that goes on for a while. And, you know, and the voice of her mother and Dr. Miracle keep urging her, sing faster. And she does, and the tempo picks up, and it almost becomes like almost a runaway train, this passionate trio, until she finally soars up to this high note and then drops.
At that point, her father comes back in.
Yeah.
Comes back to the house. And he freaks out because he sees Antonia lying on the floor. And as he gets to her, she breathes her last.
Yeah.
She dead.
End of Act Two.
End of Act Two.
Station break. You're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You're listening to our storytellers for tonight, St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly, host of the opera Cheat Sheet, telling the stories of the tales of Hoffman. Back to you guys.
Okay.
So Act Three of the opera takes us to Venice. Venice, Italy.
Yes, as opposed to Venice, Texas. And it opens with the most famous number from this score. If anybody has heard anything from the Tales of Hoffman, they have surely heard the barcarolle from the Tales of Hoffman. And it's a duet, the barcarolle being a song sung by Venetian gondoliers. And so this is a duet between Niklaus and the third of Hoffman's great loves, the courtesan Giulietta.
And for those who don't know what a courtesan is, she's...
I'm tempted to be really reductive and say she's a hoe, but she's not.
She's a high-class call girl, an escort. And she is living with her current lover, Schlemil,
yes,
in Venice. And this particular night, she's throwing a party. They live in one of the palazzos looking over the Grand Canal. And there's a sort of bacchanal going on in the palazzo, full of people drinking and doing all sorts of terrible things. And Hoffman is there. He's been invited by Giulietta.
Right.
And
we don't know, we don't know how exactly how old he is in each of these tales, but in the Olympia act, he's a younger man. He's, you know, he's rosy-eyed. Antonia, he's a little older. By this time, he's jaded and cynical.
And well, he's already been dumped twice, really.
He's been dumped twice, so to speak. And now he figures, oh, what the heck. I'll just take up with a courtesan, because why not, you know?
Yeah, the emotional attachment is not as important as the physical gratification,
there you go.
Schlemiel comes back to the palazzo and is cross that Giulietta has got all these people in. And he's particularly concerned about Hoffman.
Right. Hoffman, after singing a very spirited aria, he's kind of over this scene, and he's about to leave. And Giulietta comes after him and says, "What, are you leaving so soon?" And he says, "Well, I've lost all my money."
Because there's gambling at the party.
Yeah, yeah. And she's just, you know, mortified that he would think that that's the only reason. Well, she pretends to be mortified that that's the only reason he thinks she's interested in him. But the thing is...
Mm-hmm. Tell us.
Okay. There's another of these evil geniuses showing up in this act, and his name is Dapertutto. And she is working for him. Now, this guy is another of these shady, demonic types. And what his game is, he gets Giulietta to get these men to fall madly in love with her and give her their reflection. That is to say,
their reflection or their shadow.
Their shadow. Their reflection in the mirror, which is to say their soul. And then she then turns that over to Dapertutto in exchange for diamonds and jewelry and all kinds of lovely trinkets.
And in fact, Dapertutto, when he shows up, he's got this ring on his finger with a huge diamond.
Yes.
And Giulietta is quite taken by the diamond.
Yes, he's a big aria, Santilla Diamant, which is actually, it wasn't actually written for the Tales of Hoffman. It was written for one of his other operettas, and it got transposed into this thing, and now nobody, you know, will accept it, you know, nobody will accept the Tales of Hoffman without this aria. You gotta do it, so.
She's already worked her magic on Schlemiel and has been able to steal his shadow for Dapertutto.
Yeah.
And now that she's got the promise of this diamond from Dapertutto, she works her magic on Hoffman. And suddenly she becomes really ingratiating, and she loves him and she wants to be with him.
And fool that he is, the cynicism melts away, and he falls for it big time.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Completely.
And she says, but hang on a minute, because I'm still with Schlemiel, technically. So why don't we wait until tomorrow? However, in the meantime, I want something of you so that I will have you close to me. Why don't you give me your reflection?
Yeah.
Look in this mirror. And of course, he's so smitten that he does, looks in the mirror, and he loses his reflection.
Yeah.
And Nicholas sees what's happening and tries to get him out of there. But Schlemiel shows up again. And what do they end up doing?
Dueling.
Dueling with swords.
Yes.
And in fact, Dapertutto spurs them on. He gives Hoffman his sword, and Hoffman ends up killing
Schlemiel.
And he kills him, takes the key to Giulietta's room from around Schlemiel's neck, and
runs to her room to go join her. And as he's standing up there looking at the empty room, she hears her down below in a gondola going past, laughing at him.
With somebody else. She's with somebody else.
Yes,
as well.
She is. Of course she is.
End of the act.
Yeah.
So he struck out three times, third time now. And we return now for the epilogue back to the tavern in Nuremberg.
Right.
By this time, Hoffman is...
Blotto.
Absolutely. Absolutely blotto.
Yeah, completely out. And the opera next door lets out, and in comes the diva Stella, who's expecting to see Hoffman, and he's completely passed out.
But he does manage to get out the fact that in these three loves that he's just told the stories of, they are all sort of aspects that are united in Stella.
They're all, yeah, exactly.
And she is sort of the apotheosis, if you like, of his loves.
And now here she is finally to see him, and he's unconscious.
He's unconscious. Yeah. And Nicholas does something strange. He reverts to the muse of poetry.
Well, yes, after Counselor Lindorf. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
bad
our
guy.
Evil genius. He sidles up to Stella, offers her his arm, and escorts her out.
So Hoffman's lost out again.
Yes.
Nicholas has been the muse of poetry in disguise.
Yes.
Throughout all of this. And the muse of poetry reveals herself. And really, what this is all about is Hoffman being in love with his art.
Yes.
Not with romantic love.
Because she will always be with him, she says.
And he can use, as he has done through telling these stories, he can use those aspects of his life story, as the seed for the inspiration for his art.
Exactly.
And so we're back very much to that idea of storytelling again.
Yes.
And very weird, but that's it.
Well, that's Hoffman for you, though. I mean, have you ever seen The Nutcracker? That's seriously weird stuff.
The great thing about this opera is that it immediately, almost immediately, became one of the great French operas.
Well, and that's thanks to Offenbach's gift for melody. I mean, there's not an ounce of fat in this opera. It's arguably five acts, but every note is melodic and tuneful and memorable. I mean, the barcarolle is just the beginning. I mean, there's one hit tune after another, and it all fits the drama perfectly. And I mean, Offenbach was amazing.
Offenbach was born in Cologne. He was actually German by birth.
Mm-hmm.
He was Jakob Offenbach. But his father sent him to Paris because he was a very good cellist. And he sent him to the conservatory in Paris. And Offenbach became so enamored of France that he changed his name to Jacques. And when he died in 1880, they gave him a state funeral.
Hmm.
Because he was a star.
Yeah.
He was one of the great heroes, French cultural heroes of his day.
Right.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the opera cheat sheet.
There you have it.
Wow. Wow. What do I say? Bravo? Wow?
Or... anything you want.
This has been wonderful. And this was your first live podcast?
Yep.
Yeah, it was great.
But not our first live radio.
Yeah, oh, no, I know that. I know that. Well, we're going to give you a chance to catch your breath. We have some announcements.
Sure.
We're going to do our storytelling calendar, and if there's time, we're going to come back and ask you a couple of questions. I'm going to bring Tatiana and Nicole Rocherlin in to talk about what's going on in the storytelling world this week. I'll ask Tatiana, I guess, to go first and tell us about The Moth.
All right. Houston's January Moth Story Slam will be next Tuesday, January 9th at Warehouse Live. Come and enjoy listening or come tell a story. This month's theme is ambition, as in keeping your eye on the prize, clawing your way to the top, or just keeping your nose to the grindstone. Whatever the method, the stories will have one common theme, the quest to become the king or queen of your mountain.
Right, and what's going on at the Houston Storytelling Guild?
Well, a big thank you, as always, to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. And a reminder that they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. You can come and enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own.
And we should point out that we aren't the only ones to try doing something new in the new year. The Guild is launching a new storytelling concert series, and the first one will be Friday and Saturday, January 2nd and 13th at 7 p.m., and that's at Salem Lutheran Church on 4930 West Belford. The theme is Animal Voices, and the program is for children of all ages. Tellers include Sally Bates Goodrow, David Clunch, Andrew Gass, Alan Gardner Atkins, Sheila Phillips, and Leona
Hergsberg.
Thank you for that. More details are available on the Houston Storytellers Guild website, as well as their Facebook page, and be sure to like their page before you leave.
And of course, the other big event in the Houston storytelling scene is us.
And you don't even need a radio to hear us. You can stream us live on kpft.org and also on our very own Facebook Live. And if you visit our Facebook page, tell us what you think about our shows and give us suggestions on program ideas. We promise to get right back to you. And be sure to share our page with your friends and foes. And we'd love it if you like us before you leave. And if that's not enough, check out our program clips on our YouTube channel. If you'd like to go back into the archives and hear our past shows, you can do that too. Just log on to the Houston Storytellers Guild website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Click on the radio program link and you'll see all of our shows from the past 8 years.
Wonderful. Thank you, Nicole. And thank you, Tatiana. Back now to our guests, Eric and Sinjin. We've got about 2 minutes, maybe one or two questions.
All right.
In terms of the stories you told tonight, what would you like our listeners to take from the Tales of Hoffman?
A desire to see it.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, given that it was written in 1880, the stories are very fantastical, so they sort of transcend time in a way. Mm-hmm. And you know, we tend to think of, well, 19th century, it will be staid and boring, etc., but these tales are far mm-hmm. from boring. They really, I think, spur the imagination. Yeah. Because these characters are so so well drawn. I mean, Hoffman was a great storyteller, great writer, and what as Eric said earlier, what Hoffman has done with the music really brings these characters to life. And in a timeless way, you could watch it today, and if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know that it was written in 1880.
Opera is the perfect marriage of all the arts, and in particular, words and music. So you have the storytelling. Opera is all about storytelling, but it's elevated by the music, which weds with the words, and you know, makes something that's greater than either of them alone. And it's just amazing. I mean, I often will listen to operas on road trips, and for me it's like a book on tape. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is. And it's,
and look at the way that Hoffman melds all of this creativity in the Tales of Hoffman. You've got his work, you've got the work of E.T.A. Hoffman, you've got the work of Mozart.
Yeah.
Don Giovanni as well, and you know, and each of the stories so different,
yeah,
in terms of theme, if you like, but mm-hmm. also location, and also gravitas. I mean, Olympia, mm-hmm. young and innocent, Antonia.
Olympia is played for laughs,
right?
Antonia is tragedy,
because Antonia really is his great love.
Yeah,
because I mean, it's not Giulietta.
Mm-mm.
You know, she's a courtesan.
The hoe.
I have to say, in doing my quote unquote research for the show, I watched. I found a version on YouTube.
Oh yeah.
And I think I started watching it for the stories, and I was looking at from that angle. And by the end, I just can't get the music out of my bones.
There you go.
And the music kind of transcends this. The stories are kind of weird.
Yeah, they are.
But,
yeah.
But then, yeah. Actually, as weird as they are, they're true.
in a sort of an allegorical way.
Yeah. I mean, Hoffman is one of the founders, if you like, of science fiction and fantasy writing.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's really fitting that Tales of Hoffman is Offenbach's final opera, because it is all about the devotion to one's art.
And I can recommend, there's a wonderful film from the 1950s by Michael Pressburger, the creator of The Red Shoes. Mm-hmm. And it's a film of the Tales of Hoffman, and it's wonderfully phantasmic and colorful and rich and beautiful and amazing to watch. So find it's on DVD, find it. It's a great way to introduce yourself to this opera.
Well, it's hard to believe, but we're out of time.
No.
St. John and Eric, you introduced our listeners to a whole new genre of stories. Stories filled with emotion and passion about important subjects, I would say, like love and death and finding the match of your life. And all the stuff that makes life so painful and crazy and yet so beautiful and transcendent. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're delighted, and we hope you'll come back.
Certainly.
Absolutely.
Well, as the song goes, if you can talk to the animals, you remember that song, you'll be tuning in to So What's Your Story, because next week, Hank will host Sally Goodrow and Eric Heen in a program about animals, a prelude to the storytelling concert given by the Houston Storytellers Guild on January 12th and 13th. Hank will give you more info next week, but meanwhile, log on to the Houston Storytellers Guild website or their Facebook page for more details. And don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories. We'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, along with Eric Skelly and St. John Flynn, and the entire So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer program this hour, you can support your local non-commercial station and help KPFT reduce its pledged drives. Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT works. Sustainers help us meet our operating expenses without days and days of on-air fundraising. That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, visit KPFT.com. kpft.org to make a difference today. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
Hey, you are listening.